Welcome to the Exotic Pet Collective. My name is Richard, and thank you so much for tuning into the podcast today. I know it's been a while since my last episode, but things are crazy, and the world is crazy, and I'm trying to get these as I can. Very soon, we'll be back to recording and putting them out every week. But for now, we're going to get them in where they fit in. And today I've got a very special guest talking about a very important topic, not just for the tarantula and invert hobby, but the exotic pet hobby as a whole, which is what we focus on here. We're not just about tarantulas. You know, things are crazy all over. And, going through COVID, there's wars, there's a lot going on. But if you have been in the exotic pet hobby for any time at all, you're in any Facebook groups or following anyone on YouTube or Instagram, then I'm sure you're well aware of the America Competes Act, which has passed the House and is in the Senate, and they're reconciling with another similar bill that was passed before it went to the House that doesn't have these Lacey Act amendments in them. And the fear is that since they are in the House bill, that they, through the reconciliation process, will get moved into the Senate version of the bill and become a law, which is not good, whether you're keeping snakes or isopods or tarantulas or pretty much any exotic pet. And we're even talking birds, fish, mammals. You know, if it's not a dog, cat, or farm animal, they could very easily fall under these regulations and could make our lives very difficult. It could destroy businesses, destroy the hobby, turn, you know, people that love keeping their exotic pets into possible felons. And, you know, there's been a lot of misinformation out there that's, you know, on both sides. People saying that they're going to bust down your door and take your pets, which is not true. That's nowhere is that in the legislation at all. But there's also, people on the other side spread misinformation saying this has absolutely nothing to do with tarantulas or nothing to do with most exotic pets, that they're only going after some very specific invasive species that are injurious is the fancy word that they use. And so it's not something we should worry about. In fact, it's a good thing because they're trying to save our native environments. And trust me, I am 100% for that. I think that we should be very careful about what species we keep in this country and you know, locally, what species do you keep that could potentially be invasive? And, you know, there's already a lot of rules and laws and regulations, especially in places like Florida. There's certain species of roaches they can't have down there as feeders. Talk to anybody that sells isopods. You know, there's a lot of regulation and permits and stuff involved in that because, you know, they don't want some kind of isopod or some other insect that could potentially be invasive to, you know, start destroying crops or, you know, native fauna, different plants. And it's a thin line that we walk as keepers. You know, we're keeping an exotic animal that we're passionate about, that we love. A lot of times their natural habitat is being destroyed. And, you know, the only way they're going to survive extinction, to avoid eradication, they got to be in captivity. You see this with a lot of species of Postlatheria and many other tarantulas and inverts that would have essentially gone extinct had they not been well-established breeding programs in the hobby, keeping them alive and well and on this planet. So it's a fine line between keeping animals that we're passionate about and that we want to protect and see live beyond their habitat being destroyed, while also not keeping animals that could potentially escape or be released by somebody that's not a responsible keeper and become an issue. So today we're talking to Phil. He's the president of USARC, and I wanted to get him on the podcast to kind of address some of these concerns because I wanted to get the truth out there, dispel some of this misinformation. And try to look at both sides of the situation. You know, I don't think anybody is against common sense regulation. You know, like if there is a species that could be dangerous to humans, could be dangerous to protected species or environments here in the United States, then we should, you know, have some kind of regulation to protect those things and keep those species away. Whether it's, a certain species of snake in southern Florida, or a tarantula in the Southwest, or, you know, there's all kinds of crazy pets out there that could potentially become a problem. And I think one of the interesting facts is that, you know, he did say that they fight a lot of regulations. They go to court, they're lobbying different senators and different representatives on local, state, and federal levels trying to fight some of these bans because they're not based in reality. They're not based in science. And one of the biggest issues with this Lacey Act amendment that we talked about in this podcast is that it's regulating the entire country because they're worried that some species might become a problem in small areas of like southern Florida or, you know, certain areas of Texas. But the issue is when you introduce legislation that is nationwide to try and protect small areas, it really becomes unfair and it does more harm than good. You know, so a lot of times these types of regulations need to be done on a local level, you know, whether that's state or even a county level. But we get a lot more into that into the podcast now. I want you to hear what he has to say. But the most important thing that I wanted to discuss with him, because it's the biggest source of frustration for me, putting out these videos, putting out these podcasts, making these posts on social media, I'm getting a lot of kickback, I guess. No, kickback makes it sound like I'm getting money. That's not it. Pushback, that's the word. I'm getting a lot of pushback from other tarantula keepers, even some people that own businesses or do some breeding. And they, you know, they're essentially saying nowhere in this Lacey Act Amendment does it specifically say tarantulas or terrestrial invertebrates, which is true. Like it doesn't specifically say tarantulas in that list. But as Phil will explain to you, the way that it's worded is so vague and so all-encompassing that it could easily be argued in court that it applies to tarantulas, that it applies to mantises, that it applies to isopods, that, you know, the list goes on and on. So essentially any animal that they wanted to regulate, that they want to, you know, not include on this white list and therefore say is not allowed to be transferred across state lines or even imported into the country, That could very easily be argued and would be difficult to kind of convince them otherwise. Like there's a lot of red tape, a lot of hoops you got to jump through to get a species listed on that white list. And tarantulas, which is my passion, are definitely at risk. So it was good to hear this straight from the horse's mouth. And I use that in the podcast as well. I know there's probably a better way of saying that because I'm not trying to call Phil a horse, but it's the truth. That is what I wanted to get out. That's what I wanted to talk to him and dispel some information, kind of just calm down some of the fear-mongering. Some people will take it to an extreme that just isn't helpful and just scares people. And when you do that, you kind of you think that you're helping. You think you're trying to scare people into taking action. But really what happens is they're like, that's ridiculous. So this whole thing must be ridiculous. And it's counterintuitive. So we just had a common sense, relaxed conversation about what is going on? Essentially, what is US ARC? What's up with this Lacey Act? What can we do about it? So, you know, I hope that you enjoy it. I hope that you walk away learning something about this. And most importantly, I hope that after hearing what Phil has to say about US ARC, especially, you know, US ARC is the United States Association of Reptile Keepers. A lot of us, you know, that are listening to this podcast, maybe you don't keep reptiles. Maybe you don't have any amphibians. You just like tarantulas. I've gotten a lot of feedback. Like, well, I only keep tarantulas. I only like inverts. Why would I help US ARC? They're not helping me. Well, we discussed that. We put a lot of these myths to bed. We had a conversation about how the tarantula community and the invert community can help US ARC and how US ARC can help us. So I really want you to listen to this. I think you're going to learn something and hopefully get inspired and want to help because, you know, what's bad for the reptile hobby is bad for the invert hobby. So, you know, US ARC really is, they're from what Phil was saying, if it's at NARBC, if you can go to NARBC, whether it's in Arlington or Tinley or wherever the Reptile Expo is, if they're selling those, that species there, then most likely US ARC is going to be in the courtroom fighting for the rights of the keepers. They're going to be in Washington, D.C. or at your state legislators, you know, fighting for those rights to keep that kind of restrictive, prohibitive legislation off the books. But don't take my word for it. Listen to our conversation. And, you know, afterwards, check the show notes. If you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever, I'll have links to US ARC and some other resources in the show notes. If you're watching this on YouTube, they'll be just down below in the description. So not only, you know, just don't listen, but get involved and try to help out. But I want to stop talking, get off my soapbox, because you guys aren't here just to listen to me pontificate. You're here to get some information. And, you know, Phil is the president of US ARC. He's a very friendly guy. I think we had a great conversation. And from here, we're just going to slide right into that conversation. So enjoy and learn something. We'll see you on the other side. So to start off, I just was hoping maybe you could explain to everybody exactly who you are and what it is that you do with USARC.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the president of USARC. And if you're not aware, USARC is a 501c6 nonprofit organization. We are an advocacy protecting the freedoms of responsible reptile and amphibian donors. And obviously today we'll be talking a little bit about invertebrates too.
Good deal. And exactly like, where did this journey begin for you? Like, when did you, do you remember when you first kind of got introduced to the reptile hobby?
Well, reptile hobby, I was just one of those kids who was always outside. I grew up in the country, so I was always outside catching something or looking at something. So, you know, obviously been interested for a long time. And I think my first actual true pet reptile, so bought at a pet shop, was a California king snake, I think when I was 15 or 16.
Nice.
And then the first time I bred a reptile was 1997. I bred gold dust day geckos, was the first species I actually bred. So been keeping for a long time and breeding since 97.
Okay. And how did that path bring you to, you know, getting involved with USARC and you know, were you the president? Is that what your title
yes.
is?
Yes. So I'm the president. So I've been employed in the pet industry since 99 and worked at a, right after college, I started working at a wholesaler for dry goods, pet supplies. And with USARC, I was actually doing some work for USARC before I became president. I was doing a lot of auctions and other things for them, especially helping with the campaigns. And then in 2013, so heck, it's been 9 years already.
Yeah.
The last guy went away and I sent a one-line email to the board of directors that said, who's stepping up? And I may have been the only sucker who sent that email. And then that led to an interview with the board, obviously. And then the board asked me to become president. So you, been there since.
Kind of volunteered yourself, huh?
Yep. February 2013.
Oh, right on. So what was it about USARC that drew you to it? Made you want to support it and volunteer and get involved?
Yeah, well, obviously, I understood the importance of it, and I didn't want to see it just fade away. So, I offered to become employed by USARC, and it, like I said, here we are 9 years later. So, but yeah, USARC is a group. It's so important. If you don't understand it, I think a lot of people have realized it just in the last couple months. Yeah. But yeah, extremely important group if you're into any type of reptile, amphibian, and then obviously invertebrates too.
Yeah. And before we jump into like what's going on right now, I usually find that it's easier for people to understand their present when they kind of understand the past. So like, what exactly does USARC do? Like, what are some of the like big milestones or achievements they've made over the past 10 years or so?
Yeah. So essentially we're a lobbying group. So a lot of the day-to-day stuff is we find these issues. So we have a LexisNexis program, which is a service that attorneys use for other reasons, but we use it to find legislative concerns. So if the word Python or Traveling Animal Act or something pops up in a bill, we get an alert and then we go and research and see exactly what that says. And then obviously, if we take action on it, you'll see an actual formal USARC alert. So, you know, we go out and we find these things. We were actually the group. Out of a lot of groups that have been involved now, we were the ones that found the current Lacey Act issues in a 3,000-page bill. So again, USARC finds these issues. We do it at the local, state, and federal level. And then, I mean, we lobby or educate lawmakers on these issues. At the local level, it's usually a little bit easier to get the lawmakers to listen to you. Yeah. And obviously, they have a smaller group of people to deal with, less constituents than a state or federal legislator has. But again, it's we're lobbying and educating, and most of the time we're stopping bans. We do lose one here and there, but our success rate is on things that we engage in is over 90%, which is pretty incredible for a group our size.
Yeah, that kind of leads me to my next question. I mean, being an organization that fights legal battles, lobbies on local, state, and federal levels, you must be a pretty huge organization, right?
Well, no, we hopefully will be a little bit bigger soon. But yeah, we're a small group. I mean, just to throw some comparisons out there, before last year, we were usually between $400,000 and $500,000 is what we brought in. I know that sounds like a lot of money, but to compare it to a group that a lot of people are familiar with, one of our biggest, unfortunately, animal rights groups that we often butt heads with is Humane Society United States. You know, they're $200 million versus our $500,000. So obviously we're nothing like the groups that you see commercials for on TV or anything like that. PETA, another well-known animal rights group, you know, they're 50 million plus. So, these other groups have way more employees and way more money than we do.
So one comment, I guess, or question that's come up a lot, especially, like on my YouTube channel or in the Facebook groups and things of that nature. Some people they're not into reptiles or amphibians. You know, they mainly keep insects or arachnids. And, you know, they want to know why they should care about or support an organization that focuses mainly on protecting the rights of reptile keepers.
Yeah, obviously, that's how we started out. We are even amphibians aren't included in our title. You know, we're the United States Association of Reptile Keepers. But, you know, essentially, we try and work with any responsible keeper of something you would see at a reptile show. So when you go to a reptile show, obviously, it's not just reptiles. You've got reptiles, amphibians, and a lot of terrestrial invertebrates, too. So, and the laws are usually overlapping on a lot of issues. For example, the Endangered Species Act, you know, that was way back in 2014 when the United States Fish and Wildlife Service first started talking about listing the Sri Lankan tarantulas under the Endangered Species Act, and USARC put out a couple alerts on that. We were trying to help keep the invertebrate community informed on what was going on, and there's just a lot of overlap. So USARC is still working on doing something about the Endangered Species Act, ESA, and captive bred wildlife permits, which if you keep Sri Lankan tarantulas, you're familiar with that, what that means now. It's a permit that both the buyer and the seller have to get, and FWS just doesn't issue them to private keepers any longer.
Yeah.
So again, if we're successful on that, whether it's going for a reptile reason, invertebrates are still going to be included in that. So again, it all kind of ties together. And the same with these Lacey Act issues. The invertebrate crowd is going to benefit from whatever USARC does. So even though we're known as a reptile group, a lot of times, again, invertebrates just come into play under the same umbrella.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't think of any like reptile convention or expo that I've gone to that I haven't at least seen one table that had some tarantulas on it.
Right.
You know, so me coming up in the hobby, I just was into tarantulas for many years. Never really kept any. When I was a kid, I kept reptiles and amphibians and stuff. But you know, as an adult, it was mainly just tarantulas, and it hasn't been until like maybe the past, you know, 8 years or so that I started getting back into reptiles. But there's always kind of seemed, anytime I've brought up USARC, like either just like on social media or in a video or something like that, there's always been some pushback from people that are like, well, that's for reptile people, or you know lizard people. They don't care about, you know, spiders and stuff like that. So I was always kind of like torn. Like I wanted to, I've been a member for a few years now, and you know, I think we first met briefly at NARBC a few years ago in Chicago.
Yeah, Tinley. A few years ago. Yep, we met. Yep.
Yeah, and I interviewed you about what was going on there. And at the time, I think I'd only been doing videos for less than a year and had never filmed outside of like a controlled environment. So like our entire kind of conversation back behind the tables, mostly what you could hear were people buying and selling tarantulas. Like the mic picked up all of them. Barely got, I was very frustrated. So I could only use a small snippet of that. But, you know, it was at that time I was like, I need to become a member and really help support this and try to get the people in the tarantula hobby to see that this is mutually beneficial. Like, even though, you know, tarantulas isn't in the name, you know, you guys are still fighting the same fight that, you know, that we are. But I've always wondered, you know, when it comes to these laws and stuff like that, do you fight any law? Or like all laws that have any kind of restriction on exotic pets, or is there ever a legislation that's actually good? You know, like they're keeping an invasive species out of a specific area that could be detrimental.
Yeah, it would be nice if we could be proactive on some more things. We have been on some legislation. So we were talking about the Endangered Species Act earlier. So there's been a bill. This is the third session of Congress. We've seen the SAVES Act, which would actually relieve some of the issues that people breeding Endangered Species Act listed non-native species under human care. It would relieve some of the issues from that CBW permit that we talked about. And so that was a bill we supported. So sometimes we are supportive of things, and sometimes we support regulation as long as it's common sense regulation. Okay. But yeah, most of the time what we're known for is opposing things. So, but certainly that's not always the case, but the majority of the time we are fighting issues rather than supporting them.
I understand. And that kind of brings me to my next question, which is, you know, kind of the best defense is a good offense situation. So instead of being like reactive and fighting proposed legislation, and I know it's a small organization and you're limited on resources and people and time, but have you ever considered lobbying lawmakers to introduce legislation that protects, you know, exotic pet keepers? Or is that even a possibility?
Yeah, it is a possibility. And we haven't successfully really done that. We've successfully gotten a lot of proposed bans amended back to common sense regulations, but it was after something was introduced that was already really bad. We did try, I mean, even before myself or US ARC was even around, in Florida, the reptile industry was trying to get FWC to regulate tegus way back in 2007. And we've been pushing them every year to do something about tegus for over a decade. Yeah. And they just, they didn't want to work with us until now they've passed a ban on them. But yeah, we certainly have made attempts, but you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen.
I understand. Now, there seems to be a little confusion, maybe with just me. I don't know, but I think I'm seeing this online. But like with this, essentially, when US ARC first posted this alert, you know, I started sharing it in my Facebook group. I saw a lot of people doing it. I made a video on it and, you know, like a short little TikTok and all this kind of stuff, trying to get the word out there. And the pushback I got, and this is from like some pretty well-known, I guess, breeders and, you know, like I want to just old heads in the hobby. I don't hope that's not disrespectful, but they've been around for a while. They know what's going on. They've been importing and breeding. And the first thing they said is like, nowhere in this bill does it say arachnids or invertebrates. So, I they were pretty much like, you're overreacting. This has nothing to do with us. You calm down. You don't need to be scaring people. Is there any truth to that?
So I'm going to talk for a little bit on this one because okay. It's not black and white. It's not cut and dry. So what we have in the language of these Lacey Act amendments, they're correct. It doesn't say terrestrial invertebrates. It does say invertebrates, but it regards aquatic invertebrates. So again, in these Lacey Act amendments as proposed in the America Competes Act, it does not say that it will include terrestrial invertebrates, but here's the problem. We know that FWS holds some authority over terrestrial invertebrates. We already talked about they listed Sri Lankan tarantulas under the Endangered Species Act. So obviously they have some authority over invertebrates. And the other issue is actually within another part of Lacey Act, the term fish or wildlife does include terrestrial invertebrates. And also FWS's definition of wildlife includes terrestrial invertebrates. So people can argue that these Lacey Act amendments are not going to include terrestrial invertebrates, but this is a proposed legislation. What happens if this becomes law? It goes to FWS for final rulemaking. So FWS could potentially amend this after it becomes law. So again, they're correct that in these Lacey Act amendments, it does not specifically state that it will affect terrestrial invertebrates, but everywhere else that FWS has authority and jurisdiction, they do regulate terrestrial invertebrates. So to say that they're 100% in the clear is not accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the vibe I got. And I actually have,
I don't know. So I know, again, I know I said a lot there, but the easiest thing to do is to go, I think it's the second post on our page now. There's a Lacey Act FAQ, frequently asked questions about this, and that's a specific question on there. And I'll email it to you when we get done with this interview. But there's a question that says, does this include invertebrates? And then it includes those two definitions that I just went over and talks about again. It may not be in the specific proposed legislation now, but we certainly feel that FWS would use it to regulate terrestrial invertebrates too.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a friend that works for he's a lawyer and he works at this law firm who somebody that works there up in the upper, I mean, I'm not trying to bust them out, but they were a U.S. Attorney General for a while. And you know, so he had a lot of experience in, you know, just the legal verbiage of bills and stuff. So I went to him and showed it to him and kind of asked him to explain it to me. He's someone that has no experience with law, no degrees or anything like that. And, you know, he kind of broke it down in layman's terms for me. And when I asked him that question, he was like, the way that it's worded is vague enough that they could pretty much include any animal in there that they wanted to, which I kind of is what lit a fire under me. I was like, it doesn't specifically say tarantulas, but it definitely could kind of fall under that, especially if they argued it in court. And I even wanted him to come on my video and he was just like, no, I don't want to get involved.
And here's the other thing people have to remember is legislators don't enforce law. Legislators write law, but it's going to be enforced by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And again, you have to realize if this passes, Then there's going to be a long process of FWS rulemaking. So if you don't know what rulemaking is, basically that's done outside of a legislator and official lawmakers or politicians. And certain agencies have authority to basically write their own laws, which, you know, that's called rulemaking or regulatory authority. But after this, if this would pass and become law, FWS does still have some freedoms to change it to a certain degree. And again, to say that terrestrial invertebrates will not be included is not telling the whole story.
Right. Now, do you have any kind of like open communication or working relationship with Fish and Wildlife Service, or are you guys kind of seen as enemies of each other and there's no communication?
No, we've certainly tried. And unfortunately, this is one of those times when I got to get political. I always try and keep politics out of the politics, if that's possible. But so under the last presidential administration, we actually had a lot of conversations with then Director Skipwith of FWS and, you know, had some good communications going on. But she came on board way late into that administration, was only around for, I think, 18 months to 24 months. So it was a really short time frame. And we were getting some good dialogue with FWS. But then how politics works is after you get, so that went from Republican to Democrat administration. And then when the party changes, the new party that comes in gets rid of all the big shots that were under the old administration. So, you know, now we're working with different people and there's movement within the agency. So yeah, we do not have a good dialogue currently with FWS. Obviously we still do talk to some people within the agency.
Yeah.
And we never want to butt heads. We always make that clear. We always say, hey, we want to collaborate. We're not here just to oppose you. I would a lot rather be spending US ARC money on something else. But yeah, it is what it is. So yeah, anytime there's an opportunity, we certainly try and open communication.
I understand. Yeah. So it's always something I've kind of been curious about because I don't want to put anybody on blast, but I know that there's a guy, I guess, that's in, he's a US Fish and Wildlife Service agent that's in my Facebook group and keeps some as pets. And I've always kind of, it's felt like, you know, like he has an active interest in the hobby, but also his job is enforcing rules and regulations that, you know, can sometimes negatively affect it. So I didn't know if that was kind of the parch, and, you know, if that's how a lot of people that were involved in Fish and Wildlife Service were, like they love animals, they keep animals and things like that. So they are, you know, would be friendly or understanding, or if it was, you know, like a political, you're on the right, I'm on the left, or, you know, a black and white type of situation. So
yeah, it really, I mean, you got to understand FWS is, I mean, it's a huge agency. There are so many employees at so many different levels, and yeah, some of the field guys are good. Some of the field guys don't like us. I mean, we've even heard, you know, you're talking about a keeper. Mm-hmm. So he kind of at least minimum sympathizes with people who are keeping these. Like when the Pokies got listed under the ESA, you know, obviously he was trying to, I'm pretty sure we're talking about the same guy. He was actually trying to inform the tarantula and community on what was going on, even if he didn't necessarily agree with it.
Yeah.
But then we get other people. I mean, we've heard stories from some agents like, that still feel that we go to the Galapagos Islands and poach Galapagos tortoises and don't actually breed them in captivity. I mean, that's just crazy. I mean, yeah. There's so many people breeding Galapagos in the US, you know, those people don't have to go down and smuggle in illegal Galapagos tortoises. But unfortunately, some people in the agency just feel that we're all just illegal smugglers and bad guys and aren't in this for the right reasons. So.
Yeah. It's similar in the tarantula hobby. There's a lot of species from Mexico or South America, especially Brazil, that are, I mean, they've been around for decades and are, you know, I can't think of the last time I heard of someone getting one of them, you know, one of those species captive or wild caught, because there's just so many of them that are captive bred. And when people kind of hit you with that stereotype, like, well, you know, you're poaching these out of the wild and you're shipping them in containers and smuggling them into the country. It's like, no, that hasn't happened in a very long time. How do you fight that kind of misconception? Like, how do you get the public to kind of, become educated and maybe empathetic or understanding of our situation?
Yeah, it's very tough. Some of those other groups I mentioned, I mean, they just spend so much money on making us look bad. I mean, they do it intentionally. This is going to go outside of even reptiles. But I was talking recently to someone who was working on a local issue where they were trying to ban puppy sales. It didn't matter if you were a breeder or a pet shop, but the other side actually told a local lawmaker that everyone breeding dogs bred their female dogs six times a year. and the lawmaker believed it. The lawmaker actually asked at a public hearing to someone who was opposing this ban on puppy sales and said, "Are you really okay with breeding female dogs six times a year?" And that's absolutely impossible. But again, the things that these animal rights groups throw at these lawmakers is just absurd. And then if our side doesn't step up and educate them, they believe it, because if they don't know anything about animals and they get told this from some respected or supposedly respected group, they're going to believe what these animal rights groups are telling them. So yeah, it's certainly tough. Usually, you know, we come in and if we present ourselves professionally, whether it's US ARC or a keeper, you know, we'll get legislators to listen to us, but you have to remember they've just been told a whole lot of falsehoods from the other side.
Yeah.
And that's, so, you know, you're bringing up wildlife trafficking again. That's what they hear from the other side. The other side doesn't talk about the animals that are bred under human care. The other side talks about all the illegal wildlife trafficking that we supposedly do.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it feels like a David and Goliath situation. I mean, these people, yep, commercials running on TV all hours of the day, you know, fundraising. And, you know, it seems like they're, a lot of times they misrepresent themselves. Like I know some people, especially in college, that were, you know, really big into some of these organizations and, you know, were really big into animal rights until kind of seemed like the deeper they got into it, they realized, like, you know, I love animals. I've got a dog and a cat and all these pets. But the more into this organization I get, the more they were learning that they're against anyone, any human owning any type of animal, whether it's a cow or a pig or a dog or, you know, so it's like right now they're going after reptiles and tarantulas and things of that nature. But I would say their end game is probably a lot different than what some people that support them may even realize.
Yeah. And that could be a whole nother hour long conversation, but yeah, we see it because we're in the reptile community or vertebrate community. You know, we think we're attacking us, but they're not attacking us. They're attacking everybody. They're attacking dog breeders. They're attacking animal agriculture. Again, it's everybody. Their stuff passing or at least being proposed on any animal interest. And, you know, just to really summarize animal rights, so many people don't understand what animal rights means, but you cannot own a pet and be an animal rights activist. That is absolutely against the animal rights cult. We'll just call it a cult, but to be an animal rights activist, you cannot own an animal. You cannot touch an animal. You cannot have any interactions with animals, because that is their whole agenda, is to completely remove all animals from our lives.
Yeah. And one of my biggest frustrations when talking to people from those organizations is, you know, that they're against what I'm doing as far as keeping tarantulas. They have no understanding of the husbandry needs or, you know, the care for them. So they just see a spider in a small enclosure and they're like, that's horrible. You know, it's like, well, in reality, like in nature, I'm giving them more space than they would really utilize, you know, in a forest in South America or something. You know, but it's also just this kind of concept that, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, you know, I'm a bad person for wanting to save this, or not even save, but keep this spider that's facing extinction or eradication because of the destruction of their environment. And their whole position is these animals should be left alone in the wild and, you know, not be cared for by humans, but they're not doing anything to protect their habitat. You know, it's like, well, they're going to go extinct, you know, because it's, you could say we shouldn't keep them in captivity, but if they're not, and I'm sure it's same with some reptiles and stuff, if they weren't in captivity, you know, they could very well have no longer be on the planet.
Yeah, it absolutely is the same. And you brought up so many issues just in that short little talk, but animal rights is an industry. I always call it the animal rights industry. That there are so many people in working with these animal rights groups that are making far more money than any person working with animals ever thought about making. I mean, it is, again, it's become an industry. They've learned how to tug at people's heartstrings and get them to donate, and they just get money coming in hand over fist. And again, the animal rights industry is making far more, they're profiting off of animals far more than the people actually working with animals are. It's crazy. And, you know, you bring up good points. I mean, habitat destruction is a real thing. I hate how animal rights groups spin that being out in nature is this happy little place. I mean, think how many baby tarantulas are eaten by other animals. Yeah. I mean, the same applies for reptiles. I mean, when lizards, no matter what species it is born, most of them are eaten. Yeah. I mean, very few animals. I think usually the sea turtles are the one you see the most often. It's like one in every 10 million actually makes it to adulthood. I mean, think about the chances of an animal in the wild actually living to be an adult and breeding again and producing more offspring. I mean, it's just crazy. So
yeah,
certainly animals under human care, they can help protect species from going extinct as they lose habitat or whatever the issue is in the wild.
So what I feel like I'm hearing from you, you're saying it without saying it, is you really need some famous musicians or actors to get on board with USARC and start running commercials at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, some of that is helpful. And I mean, it's not just about USARC, but it's just about telling our side of the story. I mean, some of the best, and I know you've seen it, anybody who gets on social media, especially in our community, Betty White holding a snake. There's one with a boa constrictor, another one with a ball python, but I think there's even maybe one or two of her with a tarantula. But you know, everybody loved Betty White. So when you see Betty White holding an animal, that stuff just goes viral. So
yeah
obviously I'm not a famous person. You're not a famous person, but when you get these huge people holding an animal or talking about, you know, possibly even breeding animals or whatever they do, it gets a lot more traction than us talking about it.
Yeah, it was a few years ago. Billie Eilish, which, you know, I guess I'm kind of getting old, so I'm not like hip on her music, but I know that she was a famous musician that brought a tarantula. I don't remember if it was like an interview that somebody was doing like in her house, or if she brought it onto a talk show or something like that. But there was a lot of footage of her with a green bottle blue tarantula as a pet, and you could just kind of saw the tarantula hobby really gain some momentum at that time. It was just kind of like, wow, you know, it's like. It kind of turned from this thing that was just like the stereotypical like creepy goth kids in their basements keeping tarantulas to being like, you know, teenage girls keep tarantulas, you know? So yeah. it was kind of a cool situation just to see that acceptance kind of growing. But just to kind of get into it, one of the questions I've been getting the most, like I made this video, I guess it's been almost a month now, just kind of raised, it was right as I think I released the video the same day the House voted on the Lacey or the American Competes Act that has the Lacey Act amendments in it. And I released the video and then like an hour later, I saw the alert that it had passed. I was like, well, crap, I should have waited an extra day to include that update. So I've been getting all these comments and stuff from people wanting to know, well, what's happening now? We heard it went to the Senate. They haven't heard anything. Of course, there's like a war going on the other side of the planet. So I'm sure that's taken up some of the, you know, the legislature's time. But I mean, could you just kind of fill everyone in on what exactly is going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So there haven't been any major updates for a few weeks. I know a lot of people, they get antsy and that's understandable. You want something every day, but stuff doesn't happen every day, whether it's a lawsuit or some of this legislation. And so where we're at now, so the America Competes Act is not going to be voted on. And there's a whole lot of confusion about that. What's going to happen is the America Competes Act, which was H.R. 4521, is going to be what they call reconciled with the Senate version of that bill, which was S. 1260, the U.S. Innovation and Competitive Competition Act, or USICA is what they call it.
Yeah.
So USICA and the America Competes Act are going to be merged in a conference committee. That conference committee has not been assigned yet. So that should be both senators and House representatives are going to meet. And they're going to merge the two bills together. What's going to happen initially is the Senate version is going to take over. So really, the America Competes Act is going to go away. It's going to be replaced with the Senate version, which was S-1260. And the goal is we do not want these Lacey Act amendments coming back into this merged bill. So that's where the threat is now. So the threat is not that the America Competes Act is going to pass. It had too much stuff added onto it on the House side. The Senate's not going to like it. And the Senate calls the shots in Congress. So again, these Lacey Act amendments are going to go away at least temporarily because it's going to be replaced with Senate Bill 1260. But we have to keep these Lacey Act amendments from coming into the final, what they call the China bill in D.C.
Okay. So it's kind of like a reconciliation. They take the two bills. That's
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what we should be doing as far as like keepers that want to get involved and help is to be reaching out to the senators that represent us and say what exactly?
Like yeah, so USARC made it super simple. So we always try and do that in our alerts. If you haven't looked at a USARC alert, you know, the top couple paragraphs will be summarizing what's going on. And then if you scroll down, there's sample messaging. So we have everything from the language to use in an email. You can use obviously that same language for sending regular mailed letters or faxes. And then we even have two or three sentences there on what to say if you call in. And really, emails are kind of at the bottom level of effectiveness. It's really phone calls and then mailed and fax letters and then emails. So it's really important to do all of them and not just send off an email, but we've got it all right there. There's directions on how to find your senators with a link, and then to mail off the emails the same. We're asking to contact House representatives now because we don't know who's going to be on this conference committee. So all you're doing is finding your three federal legislators, contacting them, and that's all we're asking you to do. I mean, you could easily do it all in under 10 minutes.
Yeah. Now, is it effective to send an email or make a phone call every day, or is it just like a one and done kind of situation?
Yeah, you can certainly do it more often than not, because honestly, they're not reading your every email. I mean, some of these, we've actually had legislators tell us that they're getting tens of thousands of emails on this issue. So obviously they're not reading through, the legislators and staff are not reading through all those emails. So make sure you identify in your email subject line what you're opposed to. So we have a sample subject line there for your email. And you also want to include that on any letters because they'll kind of count that, maybe how many people are opposed or supporting a certain either Lacey Act amendments or a bill. So make sure you have that in there. But yeah, you can certainly contact them every day. And what I suggest is there are other groups that have alerts out too. So if you see another group with an alert, that will have different messaging, maybe sample messaging. So you could use that. You could also, instead of sending off our sample messaging, if you do that one day, the next day you could copy and paste some of the talking points. We have like 20 plus talking points below our sample messaging. You could copy and paste some of those and send those off. But again, just make sure your subject line of your email reads, I'm opposed to Lacey Act amendments and the America Competes Act or whatever sample we have there.
Right on. Yeah, I'm in West Virginia. So our senators are Manchin and Capito. And you know, I wrote them both as soon as you know these alerts went out and was sending them like an email every day. And I also called, I didn't write a letter, but that's probably just because I don't think I have any notebook paper anymore.
Yeah.
I have to find some. But yeah, I'll definitely have to do that. But I mean, West Virginia is a small state. Like there are, I mean, most large cities have more people than the entire population of our state. So, right. You know, it was, I kind of felt like it would be easier for me to get more of a personal response from, you know, my senators than, you know, somebody who lives in Illinois or Florida or California or something. And I was shocked that, you know, Manchin's a Democrat, Capito's a Republican. So I was kind of curious, like, well, I wonder which side of the fence is going to be, you know, more, you know, maybe empathetic or understanding of the situation. And I got back from Manchin, a form kind of like auto response email talking about getting new jobs in West Virginia. And from Capito, I got something that was about the tech industry and work from home legislation. I'm like, this has nothing to do with even like the topic. So that kind of, I'm going to keep sending them emails until somebody actually responds with something that has to do with the Lacey Act Amendment, you know?
Yeah.
It took about 2 weeks of sending emails and things like that before there was, I guess, an intern finally took the time to be like, I'll actually write this guy back and address what it is that he's saying. But I wasn't able to get any kind of feel from them on the, which side they were kind of leaning. You were going to say something?
No. So here's what happened. I mean, you can see it as you go back and revisit that it took you 2 weeks to do it, but here's how that played out. So initially they were responding to you because you were talking about the America Competes Act. So they had a canned response to that, which the bulk of that bill, remember this is now it's a 3,610 page bill is how many pages this bill is. Most of it is about U.S. economic strength and improving our technological economy. So chips to compete with China's technology. That's what the bulk of the bill is about. So those first responses you were getting 2 weeks were just about the bulk of the America Competes Act. But what happened is they were getting enough responses about those Lacey Act amendments that at least maybe they wrote a new canned response. they kind of mentioned the Lacey Act amendments. So that's a reason why it's so important for people to contact their legislators because so we're talking about a federal level bill. So we need tens of thousands, we should have hundreds of thousands of people emailing their legislators so that it makes enough noise that the staffers start picking up that they're getting this much stuff. And then that gets on the legislators' radar. And then also what it does is when USARC goes in to meet with these people or has Zoom now because of COVID, the legislators want to listen to us because they'll say, oh yeah, we're getting contacted by a whole lot of reptile keepers or whatever it is. Whereas if the general keeper isn't contacting the legislators, this doesn't get on their radar. So then when we go in, they really kind of blow us off. But if we get enough people contacting them, they want to hear what we have to say.
So don't give up. Keep
Right.
Keep sending those emails, keep making those phone calls. Now, do you have any way with, you know, maybe your contacts in Washington to get a feel for kind of where he, like, you know, legislatures are leaning as far as this legislation is concerned?
Yeah. So what we know about this stuff, and again, it's one of those times I got to bring up politics. This is just how politics fall on this issue. Democrats are fairly supportive of this and Republicans are against it. Generally, we know that these Lacey Act amendments in the Competes Act came from a House Democrat. It was inserted in there from that, because what happened with the America Competes Act, it was actually introduced last summer under a different title. And then it sat for months and months and months. And originally it was comprised of a whole bunch of bipartisan bills that had gone through committee, had gone through the process they were supposed to. But then after sitting for months, it popped back up on January 28th and had all this extra stuff added onto it. And it passed on party lines. So in the House, it was like a 222 to 210 vote. And it was pretty, all the Democrats voted for it and all the Democrats voted, or all the Republicans voted against it. But because the House is Democrat run, it passed because it had Democrat support. So again, the Democrats were the ones who were supporting all this extra stuff that was added on to H.R. 4521.
Now, I may have misread something, but it was my understanding the Lacey Act amendments were a bipartisan effort from Marco Rubio out of Florida, and then I can't remember his name, the Democrat out of Hawaii.
So this goes, everybody's, because it passed the House, it obviously got more traction. So this language is just a copy of the 2021 Senate Bill 626, which was introduced by Marco Rubio, who's a Republican, which threw everybody for a loop. Usually we don't see this kind of stuff from Republicans. But so, yeah, that, so these Lacey Act amendments, you could call them bipartisan. And that's also why it's a little bit more serious than if it had just been totally Democrat pushed. But yes, since Rubio is a Republican, he does have this name attached to this Lacey Act of language, even if it's not attached to the America Competes Act. Yeah, that's obviously makes it a higher priority than if he wasn't involved or another Republican.
Yeah. And it seems politically advantageous for, you know, senators from Florida and Hawaii to support something like this because they've had such issues with invasive species, or at least very strict about invasive species in their state. But one thing that I don't understand is why the rules that would be needed to protect an environment in Hawaii or Florida should be nationwide. Like, what is their reasoning behind saying a snake that possibly, or even a tarantula that could possibly be invasive in southern parts of Florida, should not be allowed to be in northern Minnesota? Like, is there any explanation as to the logic behind that?
Yeah, you nailed it. And that's one of the biggest issues and one of our biggest talking points. These are localized issues. So I'm going to bring up a reptile example, but the reticulated python was listed as injurious under the Lacey Act. And even their science said, so FWS based this on a United States Geological Survey study, USGS, even that USGS science said that only possibly was there a climate match in the southern four counties of Florida and the Brownsville area of Texas for the reticulated python. But FWS still listed that under the federal Lacey Act, listed as injurious. And that affects all the other states, even though it was only possibly an issue of becoming invasive in two states. So unfortunately, that's how the Lacey Act is written and how federal laws work. There's no way in there that the Lacey Act can say, we're going to list this as injurious, but that only applies to Texas and Florida and Hawaii. They can't do that because it's a federal law. So it goes across all states. And then obviously, like I mentioned earlier, one of our biggest arguments is Florida and Texas and Hawaii need to deal with these issues, which they all already have at state levels. It doesn't make any sense. So as you said, it's completely illogical to take this under a federal law.
Yeah, so I kind of had a hard time wrapping my head around that, trying to figure out what it is they're trying to accomplish. So are you maybe insinuating that it has less to do with the actual effective, like with actually, you know, trying to stop invasive species in these certain areas, and has a lot more to do with maybe, you know, some activist groups? I mean, is that, I don't want to be like conspiracy theory minded here, but like, why would they feel it important to bring it to a federal level if even their own government agencies are saying it's not a nationwide issue, it's a localized issue?
Yeah, again, that's just how the Lacey Act is written. You know, the FWS's argument, which this is how the Lacey Act currently is, it only, if a species list is injurious, it only bans importation in the U.S., which I guess, you know, that kind of makes sense. If there is a species, even if it could really only be possibly invasive in Florida and in Texas in the continental U.S., you know, you're banning the importation into the U.S. But then if it's something that we already have here, there's no reason why it shouldn't be able to bred under human care and transported across state lines. You know, that really doesn't make much sense. So if this passed, it would actually put that interstate travel ban back into place. So that's what the U.S. lawsuit victory was in 2017. It said that species listed as injurious could be transported across state lines in the continental 49 states, but they can't be imported into the U.S. So this would actually repeal that, and it would once again make interstate transport illegal.
So do you think that this language is in a direct response to the lawsuit you all won? Like, they were kind of like, well, if they're going to beat us in court, based on the way the law is written, we'll just change the way the law has been written?
Yeah, certainly. I think that, and again, it's easy to say that FWS did this, but we don't know if it's FWS or if it's someone who's a big shot caller in the Department of the Interior, which is the agency that FWS actually falls under. We don't know if it's actually an agency pushing that, or if this could totally be mainly animal rights groups pushing their legislators to introduce this stuff. So, you know, you can say it's a conspiracy theory, whether that's how this got introduced or not, we don't know, but that's still part of it. Whether that was a reason it got introduced or not, we know that these animal rights groups are pushing legislators to introduce this language.
Yeah, it's kind of the downfall of our government right now, having all these lobbyists and dark money and not to get political, but it makes it very difficult to kind of see the truth behind, you know, closed doors, what's going on in Washington. And honestly, it really doesn't even matter whether it's an agency pushing it or a lobbyist or, you know, activist group. It's in the Senate. So it's, you know, we got to do something about it.
Yeah.
I don't even know really how to ask this question, but when it comes to like trying to get the word out about, you know, it's easy for me to talk to people that keep tarantulas or keep reptiles and make them inspired or to do something. But how do you reach to people that don't keep snakes or tarantulas as pets and kind of get them involved? Is there a way to do that? Is it something that you guys have thought about, like trying to reach out outside of the community?
Yeah, it's super tough. Reptile people have been affected by this, so we're familiar with it. But yeah, certainly some of the other groups, because this is not a reptile issue. This is not an invertebrate issue. This is every non-domesticated animal could be affected by this. So this includes fish and aquaculture and birds and aviculture and non-traditional pet mammal keepers like sugar gliders, ferrets, all of those things. Any of those could be affected by this and listed as injurious under the Lacey Act. So all those groups need to be concerned with it. And we're seeing a lot of those groups jump in. The National Aquaculture Alliance was the first group after US ARC that I saw start putting out alerts. PJAC, the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council, is putting out alerts. The American Federation of Aviculture is putting out alert. I've even seen a zoo marine mammal group that's against it. So there are all kinds of groups that are against this because they understand, like you said, some of the logical nature of this. So it's certainly not just US ARC being opposed to this. But like I said, reptile people picked up on it a little bit quicker because we were affected when the large constrictors were listed. Amphibian peoples are familiar with it because there's 201 species of salamanders that are listed as injurious. So those groups kind of already were familiar with these Lacey Act amendments. So a lot of these bird and mammal and fish people are just saying, this isn't going to affect us. This is a reptile issue. It totally is not.
Yeah.
So two quick examples. I know we're already at 50 minutes, but this is a pretty complex issue. Monk parakeets or Quaker parrots, whichever you want to call them, same species. They're already listed as invasive in, I believe, 10 U.S. states. So certainly those would be probably a priority to list as injurious if this passes. And mammal people really need to be aware of this because the way this is being pushed in D.C. is that this is going to prevent the next pandemic. And mammals can carry those novel viruses that reptiles and amphibians and fish can't. So those zoonotic diseases. And virus forms. So certainly the mammal people need to be aware of that. That's how they're pushing a ban on minks, which is another Lacey Act amendment that was in the America Competes Act. So, I mean, minks and ferrets, you don't have to, some people can't even tell them apart to know what the difference is. So yeah, mammal people should really be aware of this.
And that kind of brings me to the next issue with this bill is that it's not going to have a blacklist where like these specific species are not allowed. It's essentially a catch-all, like nothing's allowed unless we put it on this white list.
That's so convoluted. So the white list, FWS is going to have a year to define minimal quantities. So if there's a species that has either been imported to the U.S. or transported across state lines in minimal quantities, it may be on the white list. And a white list is basically an allowed list. We're not familiar with it. Usually we have a black list or a ban list, but a white list is going to tell us what species we're allowed to bring into the U.S. And then there's all kinds of issues and discussion on if everything else is going to be injurious. This is another one where per the language of the legislation, it does not say that a species will automatically be treated as injurious if it's not on the white list. But we have a whole lot of reasons to believe that that's kind of how it's going to play out. Because if FWS isn't going to say it's safe to import in the U.S., why are they going to let us ship it across state lines? So we feel that whatever doesn't get on the white list is probably going to be fast-tracked to being listed as injurious, which is the blacklist. And another part of this provision is that FWS has a new emergency designation. So FWS could list 1 or 1,000 species as injurious literally the same day it posts in the Federal Register. And then they can take up to 3 years to decide if it stays on that injurious list or not. So they do not have to provide any science or really rationale for listing a species as injurious with this new emergency designation. They can list it and then take 3 years to decide if they want to keep it on there or not.
Now, you keep using that word injurious. Could you maybe just explain what exactly that means?
Yeah, the two best examples I can give is usually it's because it's really similar to being invasive. So if a species could live, and again, I got to point this out every time, anywhere in the U.S., it doesn't have to be 50% of the U.S., it doesn't have to be 25% of the U.S. The reticulated python example I gave, again, it was southern Florida, possibly the Brownsville area of Texas. If it could possibly be invasive and cause some type of harm or damage anywhere in the U.S., it can be listed as injurious. That was why they chose to list the large constrictor snakes. It had nothing to do with being big and scary. It's because, you know, they could possibly become invasive in the U.S. and then maybe eat some native mammals or whatever, you know, cause some type of economic or environmental harm. Okay. Now, the salamanders were listed just because it was possible that a salamander could carry the B. salchytrid fungus. Again, they don't know which salamanders could or could not have it, or even that there was a high risk of those animals, especially bred under human care, that they were going to carry B. sal. But just because there was that threat for B. sal, which could spread to other salamanders, not actually affecting humans or agriculture at all, they listed 201 species as injurious, which is actually still an interim rule. They haven't even finalized that rule. And I think they used an emergency designation that they already have to list those in 16 or 17, so years and years ago.
Now, you keep saying, like when you're talking about this legislation and what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they could do, they could possibly, there's a lot of kind of uncertainty. So what do you say to people that accuse you or U.S. ARC, I'm speaking broadly here, of just kind of fear-mongering or trying to get people excited about something that's, you know, may or may not actually have any real effect?
Yeah, we have to look. I mean, there are so many good examples in this, what we call the large constrictor rule, which was when they listed 9 species of large constrictor snake as injurious. I mean, there are so many good examples in there. The USGS study that they used actually said that Southern Maryland was a climate match for Burmese pythons. So this so-called science that they used said that Burmese pythons could be invasive all the way from Southern Florida to Maryland. I mean, you have to realize how bad that science is. I don't care if you keep tarantulas, you know that Burmese pythons cannot live in Maryland. And that was the science they used to justify it. And the other one is if you live in Oklahoma or Montana or Oregon or Indiana, wherever you live, it doesn't matter if that species could be invasive in that state. If it could just be invasive in Southern Florida and they choose to list it as injurious, that means that you cannot transport or sell those animals, you know, between Indiana and Illinois or Kentucky and Wisconsin or wherever it is. And this is not just about commerce either. This is any transportation. So even if you had a pet rose hair tarantula and you want, and you were moving from California to Oklahoma, you couldn't. You would be a federal criminal if you transported that pet with you from California to another state. And even for veterinary reasons, if you had a pet snake or bearded dragon, whatever it was, and even if you live right on a state border and there's an exotic vet 10 minutes away from you, if you cross the state lines with that animal and it's listed as injurious, again, you're a federal criminal if you get caught.
Yeah. And that would really be detrimental to like the NARBC and a lot of these, you know, expos that and conventions of for reptiles and exotic pets that happen across the country. Like where I live, again, it's a small state. I'm in the northern panhandle. So like Ohio is, you know, less than 5 minutes if I drive west. Pennsylvania is maybe 10 minutes if I drive east. Yep. So yep. It's like, it's pretty difficult for me to go. I mean, one of the, like I go to a pet shop in Pennsylvania. I go to a pet shop in Ohio and there's like one here in West Virginia. So it's like, I'm always bouncing back and forth. So this type of legislation would pretty much make me a federal criminal, a felon. If I was going back and forth with live animals and going to expos and things of that nature. And, you know, I feel like it's one of those things that people were like, well, yeah, it technically it would be a felony, but who's going to enforce it? You know, yeah. But it doesn't matter if they're enforcing everyone. It's the fact that they could, you know, you get in a car accident or pulled over for speeding, they find a tarantula and you're moving or you're going on vacation or something. It's like, well, you don't live in this state what exactly is going on here? So it could cause problems. It has the potential.
Yeah. And unfortunately, this is one of those laws where it's probably going to be people who aren't even making money on it who get busted. It's going to be someone who isn't aware that their pet is listed as injurious and they're posting on Facebook about how they're moving between states. And, you know, that's the person who's going to end up getting in trouble because, unfortunately, sometimes it's just about busting somebody. It's not necessarily about busting the actual criminals. It's just about saying, hey, we passed this law. This person broke it. So we're going to bust them and make an example of them.
Yeah. They definitely like to make examples. Now, there was a, it seemed like during the election, everyone on social media became a political expert. You know, they're political scientists. And then during COVID, everybody was a medical and an infectious disease, professional. And then it now here we are at wartime. Now everybody's a war expert. And it kind of seems like that didn't stop when it came to this situation. You know, just from my postings, now everybody is a Lacey Act or a fish and wildlife expert, and they know exactly how laws are written and how they'll be interpreted. And it's shocked me some of the pushback that I've gotten from, you know, people in the hobby that, you know, are pretty prominent. You know, they've been breeding for years and importing, and you know, some people that are importing are really scared and they know that their business could, you know, they might lose the entire business if this gets passed, since 90% of their sales are across state lines and, you know, they import a lot of stuff. And so it's been kind of frustrating to try and get people, at least in the arachnid and invert and insect hobby, to kind of, I don't know, just take it seriously, you know, like realize this isn't just an issue for big snakes. It's, you know, or invasive species. Like, so I guess my question is, have you ever thought about, I'm trying to think of a nice way of saying this without.
You don't have to be nice. It's okay. Just ask it however you want to ask it.
Can you help me out and add arachnids and invertebrates to the US ARC language to kind of like pull these people into the fold so they can see that this isn't just about reptiles or isn't about, you know, large snakes? Because I know that there was a group a few years ago that tried to get off the ground that was like a US ARC just for tarantulas. And I won't get into what happened there or anything like that, but it's pretty much not around anymore. Even at that time, I was like, why would we do this when US ARC is already up and running and has the experience and has the contacts and lobbyists and all this kind of stuff? Would US ARC be interested in kind of amending or adding to its language something to kind of bring, you know, the invert hobby in under the umbrella?
Yeah, again, we probably need to, because like I said, really US ARC has always done that. Again, it's, I know reptiles in our name, we pretty much try and encompass everything that you see at a reptile show, and invertebrates are a huge part of that, especially depending on which show you go to. So yeah, I think we definitely probably need to change and specifically list that we do work on invertebrate issues too, because again, we already have. We tried to send stuff out about we did send information out about the Sri Lankan tarantulas. We had two or three alerts that were out there trying to get people engaged. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was the same situation then. Not a whole lot of people got involved and voiced their opinion and contacted FWS, which you just kind of see. But yeah, certainly, you know, US ARC is going to do that. The real thing you'll see, and it's kind of the same with amphibians, you just see so much more legislation for reptiles that keeps reptile people kind of more involved. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not very often that we have to go oppose something because of an invertebrate issue, because invertebrates just usually aren't included in this legislation. But certainly, again, we're still working for invertebrate people on ESA issues, obviously on this Lacey Act issue. So it's out there. It's just not hitting you in the face every day like it is for reptile people. We constantly have alerts out because reptiles are included in something, invertebrates won't be. But yeah, certainly US ARC is still doing our best to look out for the invertebrate community. So yeah, we probably do need to change our mission statement and make sure invertebrates are listed on there.
Yeah, I know that would put a lot of people's minds at ease because the writing's on the wall. You know, just looking back at just the invert hobby the past 5 years, it's been growing exponentially. It's like when, you know, you whether you're looking at YouTube channels or Facebook groups or just businesses, like I remember there was a handful of reputable tarantula breeders that were like had a full-fledged brick and mortar business. You know, it was mainly, you know, somebody on Arachnoboard or something that was breeding a half a dozen species and selling those. And it was kind of this like patchwork of a bunch of people that were involved. But I mean, now we've got businesses that just make enclosures for tarantulas coming out, you know, clothing lines. I mean, it's like the past 5 years, Facebook groups have blown up from a few thousand to like, you know, 50,000 people. And it just like the hobby's growing. And as awesome and amazing as that is, it's also kind of putting a spotlight on it. And it's starting to get on the radar of Fish and Wildlife. And you know, it's like, so now we've got Lacey Act regulations, we've got CITES regulations. And it seems like for the first time in a while, people are really starting to pay attention to this and to care about it and to get nervous about it. And I know just in this past year, there's been a lot of issues with importing species from especially Brazil, but a lot of South American countries. It kind of seems like Fish and Wildlife Service is really cracking down. And it's like, if it's potentially from Brazil, or I can't remember, there was another country, Uruguay or something like that. I don't think that was it. But there was a couple other species that were coming from countries that weren't Brazil, but they were in South America, and Fish and Wildlife was confiscating them. And like, no, you can't import these into the country, even though we've been doing it for decades. You know, which is kind of like, or maybe not decades in some situations, but for many years. So if the tarantula hobby were to be targeted with some legislation or just enforcement of existing legislation, what you're saying is that US ARC would be willing to get involved and help out in those situations?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, what you just brought up, US ARC hasn't posted or talked about it yet, but those CITES issues, which are primarily targeting invertebrates now, US ARC has already spent quite a bit of money doing background stuff on that. So yeah, we are already spending money on invertebrate issues that are actually currently affecting invertebrates heavier than even reptiles.
And have you considered working with invertebrate dealers? And again, I'm not just talking about tarantulas, like tarantulas are a big hobby, and that's what I'm most passionate about. But there's also people that just keep scorpions or just keep isopods
or mantids. Mantids are awesome.
Have you ever considered working with the breeders or businesses that are involved with this? Like is there already some kind of business relationship where, you know, people like the businesses that are selling these animals can really kind of recommend US ARC and have the ability to sign up for US ARC at checkout, you know, or get a discount if you're a member, or, you know, things like that, to kind of incentivize people to be like, well, if I love these animals and I'm keeping these animals, then I need to be supporting it. I mean, I know people have mixed feelings about the union, but here in West Virginia, at least up until recently, unions were a big deal. They were what protected you from, you know, the government and big corporations kind of taking away your rights. So for me, USR kind of feels like I'm paying my union dues. You know, it's like you guys are looking out, doing the hard work and trying to keep the hobby safe. So what kind of relationships do you have with the breeders and dealers and to kind of help people become aware of what you're doing there at USR?
Yeah, obviously some people, like you mentioned, the CITES issues and FWS enforcing that under, you know, their Lacey Act authority. So USARC is already talking to some invertebrate people. Again, it's not something we post out there. It's not really time to talk about it yet. But again, we are doing some work with the invertebrate crowd. And, you know, some of the things you bring up, some of that falls on US ARC's fault, like being able to offer an easy discount for members or something. You know, that's something that we got to get in our infrastructure that makes it easy to show that you're a US ARC member, first of all.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly anything like that, anybody who wants to donate or do a fundraising effort for US ARC, obviously we appreciate any of that stuff. That goes everywhere from someone donating 10% of sales in a month and donating it at the US ARC. I know there was even an invertebrate convention probably 5 or 6 years ago already at NARBC Tinley, where they had a little fundraiser auction after their Friday night conference for the invertebrate crowd did and donated that money to US ARC. So yeah, anything the invertebrate crowd wants to do, again, US ARC is, we haven't talked about it and we haven't officially put it in our mission statement, but we are doing work for invertebrate people. And then even, so our alert system, obviously if stuff started popping up that included invertebrates, obviously we would get alerts out about that. But again, we're not seen as really as representing invertebrate people just because inverts don't pop up in the legislation very often. So, yeah, you know, we're not going to be as vocal about that when it's not there.
So yeah, that's true. And when they do, it's usually tied to reptiles as well. It kind of seems like they all kind of get lumped together. But for people that like becoming a member, that's the first step to supporting US ARC, right? Like not just donating, from what I've understand, listen to you on other podcasts and videos and stuff. It's really important to become a member so that you have those numbers to bring to legislatures.
Yeah, that makes a big difference when you can go into a legislator's office. If we go in and say, especially at federal level, if we go in and say we have 1,000 members, whoopee. Yeah. You know, if we can get up, I mean, there are 5 million households in the U.S. that have pet reptiles, and that's just reptiles. That's not counting amphibians and inverts. So we'll just throw a number out there. We'll just say 7 million. We'll round it up to 7 million. I mean, if we could even get 10% of that, or even 5%, I mean, that's when you're getting into big numbers. When you get up into 50,000 or 100,000, and you can say your organization has that many members, you know, that's when you'll catch an ear of a federal legislator real quick.
I mean, my YouTube channel has over 100,000 subscribers. So you would think that US ARC would have more than that, you know, because I'm just focused on invertebrates for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, our Facebook page does. It's 130 or 140, I think. We just started an Instagram page a few months ago. It's taken off pretty quickly. So we have a lot of supporters, but actual dues paying members is nowhere. It's not that 100,000 or 50,000 that we would like to see.
Yeah. So say somebody becomes a member, but they still want to do more, not just throw money at the situation. You know, they want to get involved. Is there any kind of volunteer positions, or is there any way to get involved like on the ground to help you guys out?
Yeah, we will work with anybody. And honestly, what you're doing is a huge part of it. So US ARC's revenue has actually gone up the last 2 years, and especially last year. And a lot of it is because of exactly what you're doing. I mean, obviously, almost all our resources go to finding this legislation and fighting it. We do not have a big social media presence. So people doing what you're doing and other people, other content creators talking about US ARC is why we've taken off in the last just couple of years, because more people are talking about us. So rather than spreading awareness about US ARC or just helping spread awareness of these Lacey Act issues, I mean, for example, we have 2 flyers that you can print off and distribute about this Lacey Act issue. So people can print those and hand those out, because I mean, we only attend 10 or 11 of the largest reptile shows every year. I mean, that's all we can get to. There's 10 or reptile shows every weekend in the US. So people, I mean, that's how they can get involved. They can print up these issues, just have them on a table at their reptile show that's that weekend. And then also on social media, just whatever group you're in, whatever invert group you're in, just get on there and share that. I think there was one group, I only went on at a time or two. I don't get on Facebook except to check messages. I just don't have time to go and troubleshoot all the questions and stuff I see, unfortunately. But there was a group created for this Lacey Act stuff. And I don't know if our Lacey Act frequently asked questions has even been shared in that group yet. So there's been people posting misinformation, and we create this FAQ to set that stuff straight. And then certain groups, it still hasn't been shared in there. So again, just sharing that content that we put out there so more people can see it is hugely helpful.
So helping share stuff on social media, that definitely helps. Which, you know, kind of seems counterintuitive, because a lot of times when there's a social issue going on, sharing it on social media is kind of like shouting into the wind. It's like, you know, nobody really hears it. But when you're a small group, and you're trying to get your eyes on information, it actually could be pretty beneficial. But I know that.
And there's other examples. For example, in South Carolina last year, there was a venomous reptile ban that was introduced. So we worked with, obviously sometimes we can't fly to all these issues, but we worked with a small group of people. It was mainly just one who contacted us, and we wrote like what we call a one pager. And then a handful of people just went to the state capitol and handed those out in legislator offices. So USR can give you all the tools. If you have like a state issue or local issue like that, we can get you petition forms, whatever. So if an issue does come up, you can contact us. And then that's when we need those volunteers that you were talking about, just to maybe get some feet on the ground at the state capitol or to collect petition signatures or whatever it is. It's different kind of for every issue, how we handle it. But yeah, USARC doesn't have the manpower to go do that stuff across the entire US. So certainly when issues like that arise, we can use volunteers. But really, again, it's hard to say that you can just volunteer for USARC at any time, because unless there's an issue in your city or state that really needs attention, right, we really don't, other than just spreading general awareness about USARC, there's not really much that a general volunteer can do.
Yeah. I mean, the best forms of activism is local, you know? So it's like, you know, knowing what's going on in your own city. Like I know here where I live, nothing that's really affected with reptiles and stuff, but I know that there were some other animals. They were like, you know, chickens and dogs and stuff like that. They were trying to propose some legislation. And a lot of times, especially on a local level, it's, I'm not saying like there people are bored, but there'll be like a small group that brings this and puts it in front of the city council or the mayor's office or whatever, and kind of makes it sound like they have a lot of support and it's the good thing to do. And then nobody's aware of it. Or if they are aware of it, they don't do anything about it. So it's kind of like, it creates a situation where like, well, nobody's, you know, there are people telling me that this needs to be done. Nobody's on the other side telling me I shouldn't do it. So I'm going to go ahead and do this for political points, or, you know, to get these people off my back, or because, you know, I've only heard one side of the situation. So I think maybe it is a good thing to do. So I've seen from my own eyes in situations here that, you know, just kind of keeping an eye on your local government, see what's going on in your own town and in your own county, let alone state and federal level, you can really affect some change. So if there was a situation, say that the little tiny town of, I don't even know how many people, 20,000 people live in this town right now, if they tried to pass a ban on certain species of snakes, I could reach out to USARC, is what you're saying, and you guys could provide me with information to present.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way our alert system works, we can get alerts for state and federal issues, but there's no system in place for city and county level. A lot of times we'll get alerts out at the city and county level for two reasons. One, either there's a media article posted, so that will trigger our alert system, or it's actual USARC member who contacts us and says, hey, this is coming up at my city council. What do I do about it? And then that's when, again, we'll either release an alert or we'll send out talking points and information. We actually just worked on an issue in a state that USARC didn't talk about, where someone actually had to, and just to show this can affect anybody, he was a very small ball python breeder. Yeah. He had to get rid of all his ball pythons because the city had a ban on constrictor snakes. No length, no kind of limit on it. So we worked with him and told him what to do, kind of talked him through it. He was able to bring his ball pythons back into his house. He worked with the city. Again, we're more than happy to work with you on those issues and kind of talk you through it. We may not be able to come there in person and do anything, but again, we'll give you all the tools to address it properly.
That's very cool. So if nobody's told you today, man, I do want to say thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thanks.
Because I know that that's got to be some extremely frustrating and high stress work sometimes. It kind of seems like you got a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah, especially usually it runs with tax season. Usually January through May is what we call legislative season. That's when the bulk of the states are in session. So you can get regulatory and local issues any time of year. But yeah, generally January through May are our busiest times because we got to worry about all the states being in session.
So is there anything else that you wanted to say that you haven't had a chance to say, or like a call of action or anything you want to send out to people listening to this podcast?
Yeah, since these Lacey Act issues are front and center, just contact your legislators. Again, we have it really easy to do on the USARC website. I know some people just like a form where you put in your name and address and it sends off an email. We may have one of those at a later date. It is a lot more effective. It takes just a few more minutes to do the process that we have now on our Lacey Act alert, which is pinned at the top of USARC.org. So it's really easy to find. Just contact your two senators and your federal representative. go to their website portal and you can copy paste the sample language that we have, send it off. So again, the more people that do that, the more it escalates in DC and puts it as a priority for those legislators to oppose these Lacey Act amendments. So again, if they only hear from 5,000 people, that's not even going to register on their radar. But again, if we say 7 million people keeping herps and inverts in the US, if they hear from hundreds of thousands of people, it registers. They want to protect their jobs and their votes. So they want to protect the interests of their constituents. So they're not going to support these Lacey Act amendments if they hear from enough people.
Yeah, very cool. And I really appreciate you, saying that you guys do support the invert hobby, because I think there's a lot of people that have kind of just been on the fence about it, not really sure. Times are tough, money's tight, and some people have been hesitant to send money to USARC or become a member if they feel like that money is not going to be used to protect, the invert hobby if there was ever an issue that comes up. So, just having you publicly say that is not the case, that you guys do have the invert communities back, it really goes a long way. So I appreciate you.
Absolutely. We don't do it as much as we used to, but it was fairly common for us to post a jumping spider or mantid photo on our Facebook page and kind of talk about some inverts. And personally, jumping spiders and mantids are about as cool as they get. I don't personally keep any, but I'm an invert fan. So yeah, that's super cool. And we'll do what we can for the invert crowd.
Yeah. And like you mentioned earlier, like I've always felt that if they sell it at a reptile show, if it's at NARBC, then USARC has probably got their back. It's kind of how I always try to tell, explain it to people. But some people just want to hear it straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Yeah. We'll just change our name to U.S. Reptile and Arachnid Keepers. We'll just...
You don't want to ruin the USARC.
Keep the same initials and throw Arachnid in there.
I like it. Well, that's very cool. Well, I appreciate you coming on and discussing this. I know a lot of people have been very anxious and worried because they haven't heard anything since, about a month ago when all the alerts were going out and stuff. And yep. I think people are afraid that it's passed. But, it's the federal government. It's constantly in gridlock.
Yeah, and that's why. So I know we're running long, but yeah, quickly, it passed the House. The Senate was in recess for 2 weeks after it passed. So that was 2 weeks right there that nothing was going to happen. Yeah. They got back. They had to pass a budget. So that was taking priority. Obviously, the Ukraine-Russia conflict has a priority too. So yeah, this just kind of stalled out. But we're hearing this conference committee is probably going to be assigned by mid-April, which is less than a month away. Mm-hmm. And then once that conference committee is assigned, then they'll really start taking a hard look at merging the two bills. So probably here within the next 3 weeks, we could have a lot more information on what's going on. But the way I keep saying it is, right now, let's keep that trickle going into DC of people voicing opposition to this. And then we'll open up the floodgates once we get this conference committee assigned. And we really got to focus on keeping these out of there.
I don't work for USARC. I am a member, but I'm not a representative. So everybody's sending me questions, asking for updates. I'm not the guy to ask. Like that would be USARC. That'd be you. So what's the best way for people to stay up to date? Is it to follow you on Twitter or Instagram? Or, what's the most... what's the right word? what do you keep updated the most?
Any of those. So, we have Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook pages that we update. The way to make sure that you see it is to sign up for our newsletter, which is free to do. You're signed up automatically if you become a member, but if you just go to usarc.org on the right side, it says sign up for newsletter, whatever it says. You just type in your name and email address and hit submit, and then you're signed up for our email. So at least any relevant alerts will go out to your email inbox, so you have a better chance of seeing it. But yeah, on these, people can contact us every day about updates on this, but if there's no updates, we can't give you one. It was the same for our federal lawsuit. That federal lawsuit took 3.5 years. Oh, geez. And I know people wanted updates, but it drug out for 3.5 years. So when we constantly get bombarded with what's happening, we try our best to be nice about it, but sometimes you just want to say, just go to the website or join our email newsletter. If there's an update, you will get it in an email rather than, taking up our resources with 100 people a day contacting us saying, what's going on? Again, we'll put the information out there. If it's something big that's a true update, we'll post it. So
join the email list.
If you want to follow us.
Yeah. Okay. Join the email list, follow on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You got it going on. And I know myself, I'm trying to, anytime there's an update, I try to pass that along, share it, make a video about it. I know a lot of other, YouTube channels that are much bigger than I am are doing the same thing. So you guys have got a lot of support, but you can always use more. And, you know, become a member if you haven't already. And you get a free shirt. Is that still a thing?
If you're at the 40 at the bronze level membership, you get a free shirt. There is a $20 student membership. You don't have to be a student. That's just the name that got assigned to it. That doesn't come with a shirt, but it still registers you as a member. So yeah, but at the $40 level, you get a shirt mailed out. Or if you sign up at a reptile show, you get a shirt there.
And I know we're going long, but I have one last question for you. And this has to do with fundraising. You are a nonprofit, correct? So if, like, say Facebook, for your birthday, you can have a fundraiser where people, instead of giving you a present, donate. You can do something similar on YouTube. If you put a video talking about a nonprofit, you can have people donate to it just right under the video. Do you guys have that kind of nonprofit status where people can send you donations in that manner?
Unfortunately, no. So US ARC is a 501c6 nonprofit. We have to be a 501c6 because of the amount of revenue we spend on lobbying. A lot of those fundraisers, Facebook, eBay charities, Amazon Smile, they only allow 501c3 nonprofits to be a part of those. So unfortunately, we're not even capable because we're a 501c6. And again, it's still a nonprofit. It's just, again, we have to be that different designation by IRS standards. If we were a 501c3, we would actually lose our nonprofit status. So a 501c3 can lobby up to a certain point, but US ARC is way past that threshold of allowance. So we have to be a 501c6 instead of a 501c3. So you can do fundraisers other ways. Again, you can just, you know, tally up 10% of your sales or whatever, or you could have an auction donation or whatever it is. But yeah, we can't generate that revenue through Amazon Smile or Facebook or some of those others.
Yeah, it's one of the questions I've gotten a lot. People are like, why don't you do a fundraiser on your YouTube channel? Or, you know, and I try to explain it to people, but I don't know the difference in these nonprofits. So I was,
and I'm not sure how YouTube works. I know we did just have someone do it from YouTube, but I think all they did was they collected the money during their live stream.
Yeah.
And it was sent to them. And then they sent that check off to US ARC. So, I mean, there are other ways to do it. You just can't do it automatically through those programs.
So, any kind of fundraising and stuff like that, do people need to like say I wanted to do a fundraiser for US ARC, do I need to run it by you all first?
We appreciate a heads up. You don't have to.
Yeah.
A lot of people ask if they can use our logo, and using the logo is fine as long as it's professionally done. Obviously we don't want certain things done with our logo, but yeah, as long as it's just, you know, up there and it's appropriate and whatever, you know, we can send you, if you need high resolution image or something, we can send that to you. And yeah, just really some type of heads up is appreciated. Just say, hey, I'm doing this fundraiser for you guys. I'll get you a check, you know, after it's done. Again, you don't have to. A lot of people don't, but feel free to send us a heads up on it.
I only asked this last question just because I spent all day yesterday doing my taxes. Is your donations or membership to US ARC tax deductible?
Yes. If you have any type of business license that's involved with this. So for a 501c6, you can claim any type of donation to US ARC and claim it as a business expense. So you do have to have some type of business in the reptile, invert, amphibian field or pet industry overall. Cause again, you are giving that money to US ARC to protect your interest as a business. So a general donation. So if you don't have any type of business or a business license, you really can't claim a donation to a 501c6. But anyone with a business license can.
I know I've kept you on longer than I previously had said I would, so I apologize.
No, that's fine. It's a big issue, so I appreciate it.
But thank you so much for coming on, and I'm sure people are really going to appreciate hearing this kind of insight and just the updates and stuff. So was there anything else you wanted to say?
No,
give you the last word. It. All right,
we're good. Just a quick appreciation to everybody supporting us, and even if you're not directly supporting our member US ARC, if you're just taking action on this stuff, that's hugely appreciated too. So thank you, everybody.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Phil. And thank you to everybody that's listening. We definitely appreciate that. If you have any questions, I will link everything from US ARC down below in the show notes. And I just made Phil go away. I didn't mean to do that.
That's okay.
So check the show notes. If you're watching this on YouTube, there'll be links and everything down below in the description. So become a member, share their posts and get involved. And hopefully we can stop this Lacey Act amendment that's going on. But thank you all for listening. And I will see you in the next podcast. Goodbye. Well, I just want to say thanks again to everybody for sticking around and listening, making it to the end of this podcast. And just one last time, just a quick call to action. Please go to usarc.org, become a member. I mean, donating is awesome. Fundraising is awesome. Sharing their post is definitely helpful. But like you said, the most important thing we can do as a community is to become a member. Just getting your name on their register as a member is very helpful. It gives them that ability to go into these offices, with these lawmakers and be like, we have this many members. They're paying members that are keeping tarantulas and that are keeping reptiles and that are keeping amphibians and all of these different exotic pets. So please consider becoming a member, and look into it, read their mission statement, take into consideration what Phil said, go to their website, check out their social media, follow them where you can and learn what you can. And hopefully you will be of the same mind as me and realize that this is like an insurance policy. This is like supporting the guy that's supporting me. So, I'm going to kick him my $50 a year for the bronze membership, which is, I think, is what I have. Get that free t-shirt. And hopefully, while they're going to start working with businesses, I know some businesses already do this. And I think it's going to become a trend in the invert hobby as well. A lot of tarantula dealers will probably hopefully start offering this in the future where you can get a discount if you can, show them that you're a member of USARC. So I think that's going to be very beneficial, and hopefully we can make it really easy to sign up and become a member and, get little membership cards. That'd be kind of cool. But anyways, you guys are awesome. Thank you so much for your support. I'm going to do a quick little clip of this podcast, kind of condense down the more important parts into a 10-minute video post on the YouTube channel. Since, not everybody likes to listen to a 1-hour conversation or whatever we're at now. But thank you all so much for listening. I appreciate all your support. And just a quick shout out to the sponsor, which is me, tarantulacollective.com. You've got 2 weeks. At the end of March, the merch drop ends. So those items will no longer be available. So if you want to get the Walking the Tarantula t-shirt or the Psychedelic Spider Skull t-shirt or any of that merchandise, it's only available for a limited time. And March 31st is the last day you can buy that. And then that merch drop will close. And then we'll just have to wait until the summer merch drop comes, which is probably like a month later or something. I don't exactly have that figured out yet, but those styles won't be available anymore. So if you want any of those, you got to the end of the month. That's it. Just go into the show notes. I got a link or go to my website, thetarantulacollective.com. Hit that merch drop tab. It'll take you straight to the store. But thank you all for your support. Thank you for listening. And I will see you in the next episode.